better be watching. You better be watching in the dark. You better be watching.
Mr. Pearson invited me into the house, and I thought for a second, knowing what I know now, I could have been the fourth bag under the house.
I was the main witness. I had to tell them about everything that I found, and that I felt that they were under the house. And stared at me, stared me down, and I just looked right back at them.
I'm Sonia Paz.
And I'm Mara Kospczyk.
And we are your host of Investigated.
This podcast describes scenes of true crime details and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please be advised.
Here we are. We are in episode 3, and boy, oh boy, do we have a lot of things to share with you.
And I am really excited this time around, as I always am, but this time especially because there's a lot to cover and a lot of interesting information. Because this is your case and you know it inside out, I'm going to be the investigator that asks you questions about things that we have come up with today. Because I know that you did a lot of research, and I think that's important for people to know on how well you dig up stuff.
Sure.
I also heard that you went to a true crime meetup in San Jose this last week. And I kind of want to know how that went.
It was my first true crime meetup. And I was invited by my friend Esther of Once Upon a Crime. And she had paired up with Justin and Aaron of Generation Y podcast. So it was my first true crime meetup to attend. And it was at the V-Bar in Santana Row in San Jose, and it was a blast. I mean, I didn't know what to expect. You know, I wasn't sure if it was just drinks by the bar or if it was going to be a round table of people talking. I had no idea, but it was drinks around the bar, which was fine. And and that was really awesome to have met, you know, the voices behind the persona of these really, really well-known and popular podcasts. So I got to meet and ask questions and chit-chat and meet many, many fans of those two shows, Once Upon a Crime and Generation Y. So, but they were really kind and complimentary and wished us a lot of luck. So that's pretty cool.
That's awesome. And hopefully maybe some of their listeners will take a peek at our stuff too, and we can have them come over and have fun with our podcast.
That would be awesome.
So today, we're going to cover a time frame of when Pearson left for Utah up until he got arrested. And there's a lot of interesting facts that you were able to bring up through lots of research. I know that one of the articles that you found was written by Bill Leonard from Palo Alto Times back in 1978. And tell me how you came upon that piece, and then kind of the rest of the pieces for this podcast, if you could.
Oh, absolutely. As you know, with investigating any kind of data or any historical data, you may or may not, depending on the history and the length and how far back the crimes or the incident took place, you can Google only so much. But there is a lot of information that you can find by addressing specific outlets, much like newspaper.com or Newsbank. But I had thought, you know what? I know that there was a large gap in some of the information that I was getting, and I knew that there had been more out there. So I had gone over to the library and spoke with one of the librarians and asked her if they could help me find and uncover some of these old articles, because I knew they existed. They still have some really old archival systems like microfiche and things like that. They had suggested that I reach out to the Santa Clara County Historical and Genealogical Society. And that's what I did. And I reached out to them and left a message. They called me right back. And I spoke to a really lovely researcher by the name of Mary Boyle, who was just phenomenal. Big shout out to Mary. And told her what I was doing, told her what I was looking for. And she said, go ahead and just give me a couple of days. Let me see what I can do. And within about 3 days, she had sent me a series of several emails with lots and lots of attachments to them, which contained a lot of information. Reaching out to people like that really helped out. And of course, like we said in the past episode, going in person and touching base with people when you can really carries a lot of weight and can really help with getting a lot of research data and materials.
So when you compile all that research, it's like what we're going to discuss today is the conglomeration of certain articles put together that we're going to summarize for everybody that's listening today. And what it's done for us is it's justified what we've been able to get from actual interviews of people, but give a little bit more background, like you said, during the times that it was empty and there wasn't much information. That's why I'm excited to go through these articles that you researched. The other thing we have for everyone to listen to today is an interview that you did of Mary Wingett, who was the key witness for the prosecution in this case. And she's an elderly woman now, but boy, is her memory fantastic. And everyone will hear that when we play that interview. And she has a lot of information that she remembered about Pearson. And it's amazing.
Oh, yeah. She was super nice. In fact, poring through all of the different articles and all of the case files, there were a lot of names referenced. And that's where I got most of the resources and ultimately reached out to her, met with her, and had a really fantastic interview. The article that Bill Leonard wrote for the Palo Alto Times, dated March 29th, 1978, is titled "Detectives Seek Extravagant Killer After 9 Years." As you know, in March of 1978, Detective Lieutenant Harry Burns of the Santa Clara Police Department had investigated the story endlessly and was actually thought that Pearson would still be alive somewhere living around North America somewhere. There was also thousands and thousands of pages documented in an accordion file that they had there at the police department, which was about a foot thick, and the case had occupied more than 1,000 man hours of labor since the police work started on March 15th of 74. And through Pearson's travel from California, Oregon, Nevada, Utah, and then ultimately heading toward Mississippi, he had been known for using several different Social Security numbers. But the efforts to learn whether or not he was using these Social Security numbers were fruitless. The Social Security Administration, of course, as you can imagine, they maintain these records in confidence. And of course, I appreciate that, don't you?
Absolutely.
And they won't divulge any information if Social Security numbers are being used, even if it has to do with a homicide case. And even though a complaint would have been issued, they still, even the police can't get that kind of information. Detective Burns also added that Pearson had a propensity for thievery. Pearson wasn't a drinker. He wasn't a carouser. I mean, he wasn't going to get arrested in a cat house. But his financial needs were far larger than his earnings. And if he wasn't able to talk his way out of it, then, you know, maybe they would have been able to get him. And as we know by now, Pearson, he was a pretty shifty character. I mean, he was on the constant move. And Detective Burns had also said that they had a hard time tracking him down because even though he was supposed to have made attempts to update his registration on his car and update his driver's license, he never made any attempts to do any of those things. And we also found that he often sold cars and kind of disposed of them along the way. So that was sort of his MO.
So interesting. It's obviously relevant that the detective in this case looked through the thousands of pages and thousands of man hours on this case. And you can definitely tell just by this first portion of the article that Pearson had an MO for sure. He was kind of like a grifter. He would take and seek opportunities with women and blend in with their lifestyles, which is the easiest thing to do. Instead of being outgoing on your own terms, you blend in. And that's how I think he got away for so many years. And it's really interesting that he knew in his head that if he didn't have a driver's license or renewed a driver's license in a certain state or got insurance or even kept a Social Security card that was new or updated, that he would be able to slip through the cracks. And that's exactly what happened, is he slipped through the cracks for years and years.
Right. And I've thought a lot about this. It's almost, I mean, I listen to a lot of podcasts. I read a lot about people who are con artists or, like you said, grifters. And it's a high for them to get away with stuff. And what does it do? It only feeds to do more and more.
Absolutely. And it's almost like they have a narcissistic attitude towards people and society in general, that they're always right and that they can get away with whatever they have schemed in their minds.
You're absolutely correct. And the con game was high and mighty for this guy. The authorities had been in communication with Arlene Rouche, who was Pearson's second wife, the one that lived in Utah. And she had since remarried and moved out of Utah to Nevada. But authorities stayed in constant communication with her because she was still very much concerned about the fate of her young son. Questions were, was he still alive? Where had he been? Where were he and Pearson living? Everyone was really concerned and worried for the safety of this small child. And Burns had said, we don't know if the child met the same fate as Pearson's other children, with those questions again, is he alive or dead? And whether the father is raising him on his own. So as a mom, I mean, those are just bothersome to me. I can't even imagine the angst that this poor woman had felt in not knowing that her, you know, her child had been just taken one day.
So the interesting thing about Pearson is now when he moves on, he actually takes his kid, kidnapping obviously, and vanishes. And this poor woman is left with no idea what's happened to her son, because you have to realize that this is in the 70s where we don't have social media. The only thing we really have is police agencies talking with each other and the FBI, and that's the only way that they can locate people nowadays. And so what you have is a network that's a good network, but it's not like what we have today where people are witnesses with their own cell phones and cameras and can take pictures as events happen, and police can use those and locate people much more quickly nowadays than back then. And so not surprised that law enforcement kept in touch with her, because who knows, he may have meandered back into her life and then they were maybe able to catch him that way. But that's not the way it actually worked out, is it?
No, not at all. What I found really interesting in this article was, since Pearson was an avid golfer, the detectives got pretty creative. And I got to give them kudos for this, because this, not to pat myself on the back, but I would have thought of this. They actually contacted several golf magazines and trade periodicals to have notices circulated and published in those magazines throughout the country, because, you know, someone could probably see him or recognize him because he was so identifiable. Also, similar warnings were published in optometry and ophthalmology trade magazines and publications, because Pearson had suffered from astigmatism and at some point presumably would have had to have his eyes re-examined for glasses. Speaking of health and things like that, there was a heart condition in the Pearson side of that family. And if Pearson was to have died of natural causes under an assumed name, they would have never known. They would have never known.
Right. Detectives in this case actually started their own social media platform by using publications to spread the word about Pearson. And I too have to give them kudos. That's one of the smartest things you could have done back then. And the other thing that we can all remember as kids or teenagers is walking into the old post offices and you would see the FBI's most wanted lists in all those. And that was another way that people could get ideas from FBI posters and knowledge of people who are wanted in the post offices and get the word out that way.
Right. Absolutely. And in our last episode, we went into detail what his life was like in Utah as he had changed religions, worked at a hotel, managed to embezzle money, and rob his former business partners for over $50,000. But let's talk a little bit about what was going on in Biloxi at this time.
Right. He then moved from Utah to Biloxi, Mississippi, and again, started a new life.
Yes, sirree, he certainly did. In December 1971, he arrived in Biloxi, Mississippi with his son and quickly met single mother Jacqueline Nichols, who at the time had a four-year-old daughter, and they dated roughly for about a year or so, and then the two wed on January 5th, 1973. This is Pearson's third wife, right? Pearson kept himself employed as a shoe salesman at Grider's Shoes in downtown Biloxi before going to work for, and pardon me if I pronounce this wrong, going to work for Lou Sonnier Shoes, S-O-N-N-I-E-R. And if anyone's listening and I'm saying that wrong, please just, yeah, sorry. Eventually, the family would relocate to a town in Mississippi called Saucier, S-A-U-C-I-E-R, which is roughly about 30 minutes or so from Biloxi.
So here's another example of Pearson blending into his situation, right? He mm-hmm. picks a woman who has a four-year-old daughter and he has a young son. So she's single, has a kid, probably needs some help financially. He talks his way into her life and they put their lives together. Within a year or so, he marries her and is employed as a shoe salesman, and then they move, which is interesting in itself because I think what he has in mind is if he moves her away from her surroundings and they create something new by themselves, less of a chance of him getting caught.
Right. Blending and moving and shaking.
Right. Exactly. And that's what, you know, it's interesting. Out of the cases that I've worked on with people who are serial killers or serial rapists, that's one of the biggest things they have in their repertoire is they are diagnosed with narcissism and they can completely play the game well. I had a case in Seattle that was a serial killing case. And if you would have met this guy out on the streets, you would have voted him to be mayor. He was that smooth.
Wow. Yeah, that's crazy.
And I'm thinking Pearson was that same way. He was a smooth operator.
Oh, yeah. And smooth he was. In fact, at the time of me editing this audio, I decided to contact the Biloxi Historical Society and spoke to the gentleman there who owns the site and manages everything there by the name of Ray Belandi, was incredibly helpful. I called him because I wanted to verify a couple of facts. One thing was the Lou Sonnier shoes. I wanted to make sure it was not Sonnier, but it was Sonnier, and he verified that. Of course, I gave him the whole skinny of why I was calling and the reason for the call and the story that I was writing and for our podcast and everything. And he had asked me if I needed anything and if there was any kind of search he could do on his end. And so he did provide me with a couple of things, which were really, really helpful. One was the announcement in the Sun Herald in January of 1973 about the marriage license applications that had been listed. And it does state right here that George David Watson III and Mrs. Jacqueline Marie Nichols, both of Biloxi, had filed an application, which is funny because it says both of them were from Biloxi. And of course, we all know that he wasn't from there. But yet again, like you said, he blended, he was smooth. And when you're confident, I guess, to spread the lie, then it's believable. The other article that he had, which is kind of an extension of one of the articles that I had already, but it just done a little differently, was written by Stephen DeSanti of the Daily Herald, and this was dated on Monday, July 31st, 1978. And it pretty much goes through most of what we have already reflected on. However, it says, under the alias of Watson, Pearson became a respected member of the Biloxi community, even being an elected president of the Biloxi Merchants Association in 1977. And it just goes on to say that he had married a Biloxi woman, lived in North Biloxi, and friends described him as a gentle and religious man. What I find really crazy is that here's a guy who's running from the law. He's left California. He left Utah with, of course, a child. And here he is, the president of a merchants association, although throughout a different name. But there he is, right there for the whole world to see that he's, you know, George David Watson III, and he's the president of the Biloxi Merchants Association. And, you know, maybe just not a little bit afraid that he might get noticed by somebody just being all out there. I'm going to reflect back for a second, back to 1947 when James and Pauline were first married. He worked at a shoe store in Pendleton, Oregon, and it was one of his real first professional jobs. And the shoe store that he worked at was called The Bootery. So this is what I find completely interesting is that here we are. It's just a real full circle of how things were with his professional career. He went and started off doing that in the 40s, and here we are in the 70s, and he just went back to a job that he knew.
Yep, go to what you know.
Go to what you know. So, Mark, you mentioned the thing about the post office and getting to, you know, see different wanted criminals on the walls of the post office. That was kind of the norm back in the 50s, 60s, 70s. So in the summer of June of 1978, there was a young couple in the Biloxi post office purchasing stamps. Their young son happened to notice the posters, and the young boy had said to his mom, "Mom, look at that man up there. That looks just like Mr. Watson, the man that we buy our shoes from."
Right. And there you have it. You have a kid who's kind of paying attention, probably bored being with mom and dad in the post office, and looks up and sees this picture of, you know, AKA Henry Kissinger, who is, you know, that look is pretty prominent. Not everyone looks like that. And the kid points out to his mom and dad, "Look, that looks like Mr. Watson, our shoe salesman."
I know. Go kid. Maybe this could have been a reflection that, you know, try not to, if you're trying to hide out, try not to be out there for the whole world to see Mr. I'm going to be the president of the Merchants Association.
The start of the end for Mr. Pearson, right?
Oh, yeah. Definitely the beginning of the end for this guy. The couple, of course, agreed that the uncanny resemblance of the man was the kind salesman that they had often purchased shoes from. So they quickly had notified the Gulfport FBI office in Mississippi, and with this long-awaited tip, and reported Mr. Watson, or rather James Arthur Pearson, or rather Albert D. Four, to the FBI. On Tuesday, June 27th, 1978, the FBI of the Gulfport office entered Lou Saunier's shoes and saw the tall, strapping, six-foot Pearson on the sales floor. They looked at the wanted poster. They looked at Pearson and concluded that the resemblance was striking. They requested Mr. Watson speak with them privately in the back office. They were professional, you know, they don't want to embarrass this guy on the sales floor. They asked George Watson if he was indeed James Arthur Pearson. Watson responded that he was not that person. However, when the agents then requested to have Watson accompany them to the FBI office to have fingerprints taken to verify his identity and rule out any possible errors, it was then that Watson said, "It's me. I'm James Pearson."
Right. There you have the difference between someone who is a grifter and a thief, knowing that the gig is up, surrendering to the police without any issues, because they know at this point, and he knows at this point, that they have him. So he surrenders. He has to. He has no way out.
Right. There's no way out. I mean, that he's carried around this giant suitcase of chaos for so many years that maybe it was a relief to finally just say, yeah, it's me. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, could have been. Could have been.
So the FBI obviously took Pearson into custody and immediately brought him to the FBI office and had notified the Santa Clara Police Department. And needless to say, they were elated. They just thought, we got him. We finally got this guy.
Right. They did get him finally. But what was very interesting to me, like we were talking about earlier about serial killers or rapists, that sort of personality, is what the police shared in this article with the store owner. And that's what I found very interesting is, again, you would have never known that Pearson was who he was based on the store owner's recollection of him. And share that with us.
Saunier was noted as saying that Pearson had never said anything to him about it being a fugitive, and he described Pearson as a wonderful man and that he was very pleased with having him as an employee and had also said that, I will always remember him as George Watson. He was a good man.
So you have the same thing. You know, you have a criminal that's arrested next door to you and the neighbors always say, wow, he was such a nice guy. But he was a convicted murderer, right?
Right. And child abductor. And, you know, and married other people that he hadn't been quite divorced from yet. Yeah, he was racking up the punch card there, I think.
He was, totally. So then Pearson was taken to the U.S. Marshal's office with a $100,000 bond and was extradited back to California.
Correct. Yep. And transported to the Santa Clara County Jail on Thursday, June 29th, and was arraigned before Santa Clara Municipal Judge William F. Brown Jr., and was held without bail at the main jail in San Jose. And a hearing was set for Friday, July 7th, 1978, for Pearson to enter a plea. And the prosecution had argued that he was a flight risk, that he needed to be held without bail because he was slippery. And so they needed to make sure that he wasn't going to be dashing out, because I would wager to say that would have been the first thing he would have done. And who knows where he could have ended up. He could have just, you know, scooted right out of the country.
Right.
Easily.
And what's interesting to me is back in 1978, most people were given bail no matter what their charges were, unless it was a horrific charge. I mean, this was a triple murder, no doubt. But I think there were a lot of theft charges that were pending for Pearson. But I believe Santa Clara wanted to take on the murder charges because that's what was going to give him the most time. And I think that's what they were concentrating on.
Right. So as you had mentioned, we have the interview of myself and Mary Winjet that was done in January of this year. And we'll go ahead and have a chit chat about it after we listen to this. I am here today with Mary Winjet. She is one of the prime witnesses on the Pearson case from 1978. And thank you, Mary, for being on the show today. I really am honored to be able to talk with you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I want you to just to tell me your story and how did you get to know them?
They lived next door to my parents on Woodhams Road. And that's where I got to know the family. I guess that's when he called me, because I was probably the least likely of the people that he knew to ask a bunch of questions. But he doesn't know me very well, so.
Yeah. How old were you at the time?
Oh, my gosh.
Maybe.
I was in my 20s, okay. Yeah. And he called and asked me to come up to the house on Claremont. And when I got there, he asked me if I would take his dogs. And I said yes. And when I went to the garage to go get the dogs were trying to get underneath the house. And he picked them up right away, and they were growling and everything. And He put him in my car, and then I went back into the house, and he said, I have a lot of stuff to do, so I'm going to go. And I said, okay. And I found a bunch of murder mystery books from Earl Stanley Gardner, and all of the plots, how the people were killed, were all underlined in every single book. I thought that was really odd. Mm-hmm. And then as I started looking through the house, excuse me, I found the girls' makeup and hair rollers. And I thought, these teenage girls do not leave without makeup and hair rollers. I don't care how fast they had to get things together. That's just not right. And then the green shower curtain was missing, and that was in my head for all those years. And they were wrapped in the green shower curtain. And then he had called a used furniture man to come and take the rest of the furniture. And I thought, well, why isn't he taking that with him if her brother was killed and she had to go back there right away because he had a meat packing company? And I just thought that was odd that he would just get rid of everything.
Yeah.
And then I found, when I went in the garage, I found a sledgehammer and some other things, and just something told me to take it with me. So I did. I took everything that I could with me, and I put him in my car in case he came back, which he did come back later that evening. And he talked to my husband about doing something to his car because my husband was a mechanic. And so he fixed the car. And I kept telling Mike, I said, there is something wrong here. And I said, I feel it. I just feel it. And he said, oh, you're crazy. Just let it go. There's nothing to worry about. And I said, no. I said, I should call the police. And he said, if you call the police, what are you going to tell them? You don't have any evidence. And I said, well, you're right there. So I let it go. And then after the guy came and took the furniture, and he had left, Pearson had left to go wherever, I guess he went to Utah because that's where he ended up. And that's what I read, that he went to Utah and married this girl and had a son. Took the church, the LDS church, for $50,000. And then he went to Mississippi and ended up in Biloxi, Mississippi, and married this girl and took his son with him. Apparently, the woman couldn't do anything about it. He just took the son because she tried to get him back, and she couldn't. So I don't know the story behind that. But when they caught him in Biloxi, Mississippi, then he was extradited back to Santa Clara. And that's when the trial was held. And the only witnesses was his boss from the credit bureau and the oldest girl's boyfriend at that time, and then myself. And with all of that evidence, then he was put in prison.
And how long do you think you knew them? I mean, when you lived next door.
And they were renting that house.
Okay. Do you think they rented because he just didn't have enough means to purchase a home?
I have no idea.
Well, he got out of there pretty quickly, so.
Yeah, when he lost his job, and she went to work.
The Kitty World Fashion.
Kitty World, yeah, Kitty World. And I know they didn't have a lot of money because he had a hard time getting another job.
Right.
But the oldest girl went to Amsterdam, I think with a class. It was a school thing. And when she came back, he had claimed that she was smoking marijuana. And I thought to myself, this girl, this very unlikely that she would be doing that because she just wasn't that kind of a kid.
Right.
And I guess apparently he got very angry, lost it, and killed her. And then the youngest daughter ran to go get the mother and let her know what was going on. And they both came back home, and he killed both of them. I just don't understand why she didn't call the police, because the youngest girl knew that her sister was being killed.
Right, right. And I've thought about that. The only thing I can think of is, I mean, back then we had phones that were fastened to the wall. Mm-hmm. So, and we didn't have cordless phones then. Right. So in just the haste of being upset, maybe just ran out. And
yeah,
you know, because she was only about 14 at the time. So let me just go back just a little bit, because I know when we spoke on the phone, you told me in detail about the situation with the dogs, and that you had gone over and the dogs were digging.
They were digging under the kitchen window. And I thought that was strange. After I got the dogs to my house, I went back to that house and I walked all around. And they had a swimming pool, except for the very back, which was a short area. I didn't go back there, but that's where the crawl space was. And that's when the termite inspector, when they went to go sell the house. Apparently, there had been a long enough time for the bodies to decompose before they rented the house again. I mean, otherwise you would have smelled that. I mean, three bodies.
Yeah. There was one neighbor that told my mom that she had helped with disposing of things also. I don't know if you knew of another person, but she had gone over there and smelt something in the backyard, but just thought it was the swimming pool that was just
tenacious earth. The garage was attached to the house. And there was a window where the kitchen was, a window. And the dogs were digging under the window. And there was rocks there.
But they were digging here. Here.
Yeah.
Because they probably smelled something being under there, you think?
Dogs know. Dogs are very instinct. They just know.
When they were digging, he got really nervous, you said?
Yes, and picked up both the dogs and told me to please take them right then and there. He said, because I don't want them to run away.
So you were saying that the things he had you disposing of was the makeup and the curlers and things that a young teen wouldn't necessarily forget.
Right. Those are the things that I took home with me.
Okay.
And because if there ever was anything, and there was, at least I would have evidence.
Correct.
Of what I felt.
Right.
Yeah.
And you said that when he had left, you found a sledgehammer and these mystery books. Describe what the sledgehammer was. It was tall,
like this.
Like 30 inches or so.
With a big, because that's how they made them in those days.
Do you think that that's what he actually killed them with?
Yes.
Not this meat hammer story that he...
No, it was a sledgehammer.
Because I remember the dogs. I remember Pauline used to play the piano, and when they lived on Woodham's, and, you know, I was 7 or 8, but Marianne used to babysit. But I used to go over there, and we'd just hang out, and Pauline would play the piano, and the little dog would sit next to her and start to sing along, and we would laugh, and it was funny, you know. So you said that you also found a book. It was like a military, was it an album or like a personal scrapbook of his or some type of yearbook?
No, it was from the military. It had everything about him and his platoon and where they went when they returned. It had everything like that in there. I guess they give them that when they leave.
Okay. So he had to have been honorably discharged, or he wouldn't have gotten any of that, I would assume.
But how could he not have a driver's license or Social Security card and be in the military? I don't understand that.
Yeah. So did the investigators tell you that, or did he tell you that? Okay. The investigators stated he didn't have any kind of
ID. And I think it was even mentioned from his employer, which kind of surprised me, because wouldn't you think the employer would ask about those kinds of things if you put somebody in management?
Right, right. You especially, know? He worked at a credit bureau.
He was manager of it.
Right. And That's like the, he's got the lay of the land to assume or maybe have acquired somebody else's identity. I mean,
yeah, and I would have liked to have known what happened before he ever met and got married. You know, yeah. I'd like to know that if you ever find out. Because there's something there that is just isn't right.
Right.
So,
you know, as you know, the story is not just about the murders. It's he escaped to Utah and then met a woman, fathered a child, abducted that child, disappeared, went to Biloxi, started a new life with a new wife and new kids and a stepdaughter. And they changed this boy's name and lived this grandiosa life for 5 years.
And he wasn't even divorced.
Oh, no, he wasn't divorced. And I can't seem to, the state of Oregon, I mean, the state of Utah will not release that to me.
Really?
Yeah. They're saying it's private information.
You know what? My brother is very big in the church. I wonder if he could get it.
Oh, from the church?
Yeah, he stole $50,000 from the church.
Yeah.
He became a member of the LDS for that very reason. He knew how to manipulate people.
Oh, yeah.
To get what he wants.
So this here, this is their marriage license from Pendleton, Oregon in 1947, where it states where he was from, his name and all his information. And then Pauline, and did you know that she came from Czechoslovakia? She wasn't born in the States. She came here and I learned, and you had verified that she had a brother.
Yes.
Did you ever meet any of the family?
No.
So it's harder to get information about her background because she had come here, and I don't know what age she came here, but she was also 7 years older. She was 29 when they got married, and he was only 22.
Oh.
So, I mean, not that that's bad or anything, but they were married by a Catholic priest and all that. So that's what I was able to find. I have not found any birth records for either of the daughters.
No birth records?
Well, I can't seem, the state of Oregon has, because my research shows that they were either born in Pendleton, Oregon, or they were born in Salem. And I've been in touch with those municipalities, government offices, and they're saying, well, you know, we just don't release things. And then the other excuse is, well, we don't have things that far back. I'm like, yeah, you do. You do.
Yeah.
So I'm still trying to find that out. But James Pearson had a twin sister.
Oh, I did not know.
I didn't know that either. But there's a Joanelle Pearson. Well, he had an older brother who passed away at the age of 5. Due to something called juvenile paralysis. Mm-hmm. And he was born in 1921. And Pearson and his twin sister were born in 1925. So, and also found out that his father, James Pearson's father, left his family with a wife with 3 kids. So that behavior is similar. But I don't recall ever meeting family when they lived next door, and I don't recall them ever going on vacations because money was an issue. Do you remember interacting with the girls much, or can you tell me about your encounters?
No, because it was such a difference. I mean, I was in my 20s, and my daughter reminded me, she goes, you know, Mom, I was born then. And I said, you know what's really crazy? I don't remember being pregnant with you. And having all this, I don't know, all this turmoil. I said, no, I just don't remember it all.
Yeah.
I don't know if I just put it out of my mind or if I just didn't think about it enough at the time that maybe there was just too much going on.
Yeah.
Because I was working all the time. And what surprised me was when I got the phone call, because other than just talking with her every once in a great while, I really didn't know them.
My mom and dad, they've both have passed away, but I would talk about this with them over the years, you know, asking them questions. And what did you say happened? My dad had a sharp memory. I mean, both of my parents have just
had really just incredible memories of things that happened. And I remember when the detectives came to talk to my mom and dad. Mm-hmm. And in my memory, my thought, I'm pretty sure it was a Saturday.
I think they came to my house on a Saturday, yeah, too.
And when I talked to my brother and I said, well, what do you remember? And he said, well, they came over on a Saturday. And I said, yes, they did. And so when I was talking with one of the retired officers who I'm going to be doing an interview with in a couple of weeks, I said, I think y'all came over on a Saturday. He goes, probably, because homicide has no schedule. So that was like, okay, I know now that I'm not, this is not something in my imagination.
Yeah, because I know I came home from work because I worked at Safeway.
Okay.
We must have moved there after, because I do remember placing all those items in the garage, in a certain area in the garage. And I told Mike, don't ever touch this area. For any reason, don't touch it. Don't let any of your friends touch it. Mm-hmm. Because this is evidence. He would go, oh, yeah.
Now people, yeah. I mean, it was a different time then. When I had posted a video, this little video I did was, let me tell you the story about this family that lived next door to us, that kind of thing. And this happened, that happened. And someone had wrote, well, you know, how come the daughter just didn't call 911? And I wrote, well, 911 was established in 1968. It really wasn't even part of anything in the teeny little Santa Clara back then. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have a phone we can grab. 911 was very, very, very new versus having to dial. Pauline's persona, you just vaguely remember?
I just remember her. She used to bake. Other than that, and just sitting down and chit-chatting for a few minutes over a cup of coffee,
sure.
That's all I remember.
So he basically just called you and said, hey, Mary, can you come over and help me clean out the house?
Exactly.
And you said,
just out of the blue. Yeah, I was very surprised about that. But I'm glad he did, because at least I knew. I'm one of these people that if I walk up to somebody and they have a bad aura, I walk away. Mm-hmm. I just, my senses are pretty keen.
Oh, yeah.
So when I felt that, the minute I walked into that house, I knew that I had to really look for stuff.
And you noticed the shower curtain right away.
Yeah, that was the first thing I noticed. Like, where's that green shower curtain, and why would it be gone when everything else was there?
What did he say? Do you remember what he said?
No, he was gone then.
But he gave you a key just to...
Left the door open.
Oh, well, back in those days.
Yeah, you didn't worry about stuff like that.
So the shower curtain gone, and then you said you found the books and the sledgehammer in the garage,
the books were in the bookcase. In the living room.
And then what happened to those? Did you take those also?
I took those.
Oh, okay. And then I assume that the officers acquired that for evidence.
Yeah, they have.
Okay.
If it had just been one book where the killings were underlined, that would have been one thing. But every single one, and there had to be 10 or 12 of them, every single one of them. So that made me very suspicious then.
Wow. How do you think the officers knew to call you? Was it random or?
No, it was a neighbor. It was a neighbor that knew me and told them that I was the one that came and cleaned up, took stuff out of the house, and took the dogs. I don't know why they didn't call the secondhand store guy. I mean, you would have thought that they would have contacted him somewhere along the line.
There was one article. No, it's in the testimony, because I went to the county. Mm-hmm. He had rolled up the carpet and threw it behind the shopping center, which was the food villa, and discarded other things in their trash.
That was Lamont. I looked for blood on the walls and stuff like that, but I didn't. He must have cleaned up well.
Right. And do you believe that the story he told about the girls rolling cigarettes and smoking?
No, I can't even imagine that happening. And with him being home? No. No. I think he just lost it. I think It had something to do with her trip, probably. And I don't know, he just lost it.
Did you ever see him have any outbursts of anger at all?
You know, I even went home and told my mother, I said, you know what, that man next door is really weird. I can't pinpoint what it was, but I always thought there was something very strange about him. And like I say, with my feelings, and I just kind of wanted to not be around him. Mm-hmm. I didn't trust him.
Yeah. Yeah. But my dad had gone golfing with him at one point and said, came home and told my mom, boy, that was a strange golf game. He goes, this guy next door, man, he got so mad he was taking his golf clubs and hitting them against a tree. But so he left the house in just disarray. Were you able to clean the whole thing out? Was that what he wanted you to do, was just clean out everything and throw
it? No, actually, just take the dogs and...
Oh.
And that was basically it.
Okay.
But when he left and I was still there, I started snooping. And that's when I found different things. And I took him out because he said something about the secondhand store man was coming to get the furniture and stuff. So I knew I had to take that stuff with me.
In talking with one of the officers, he does not believe that he owned the house either.
He didn't.
Yeah.
He didn't because in the paper, it came out that he rented the house. And because the house was rented and they didn't go underneath the house when they rented it to this other people, mm-hmm. because there was no reason to. If he had sold the house, then they would have found the body sooner.
Yeah.
Well, I know they didn't buy the house because they didn't even own the house next door to my parents.
Tell me what happened when you were at the court and during the trial. Were you there for the whole time or just
yes,
brought in?
I had to be there for the whole time. I was the main witness. I had to tell them just what I'm telling you about the books and everything that I found. And that I felt that they were under the house and brought up the green shower curtain again.
Yeah.
But I had a gag order. I couldn't talk to the press at all.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why. I mean, he wasn't that big of a... It was not like he was a celebrity or anything.
Yeah.
You know, but... Or maybe because there weren't so many witnesses. I know her boyfriend was only on the stand for like 5 minutes.
But... Another piece of information I found really interesting is that back in the day when you had phone books and stuff, they listed your occupation in there as well. I mean, I don't know if they just didn't know this, because in here it says if the investigators probably would have known this, they would have probably found him sooner. But, and I'm not being critical, but in here it says that James and Pauline Pierceman, he's a salesman at the Bootery. He worked as a salesman at a shoe store in 1947. If they had this information, that might have led them into knowing what kind of areas of a profession that he may have gone back, you know, something familiar that he would have known that he would have blended in.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just me probably overthinking it.
Oh, it's something that he knew. So, yeah, he was out of a job. He had to work someplace.
So the gag order was just not to talk to anyone about the case ever, or just during
the
trial?
No, just during the trial.
Oh, okay. And then, and you obviously made eye contact with him. He saw you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. He stared at me, stared me down, and I just looked right back at him like, you stupid jerk.
So he stared you down, but you weren't intimidated. When
no.
he stared you down...
I've
you
never
just...
been intimidated by anybody.
Yeah. Do you realize that your testimony was
the one that sent him up the river? Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. He was in there for 38 years. So he was released in 2013 at the age of 88.
Yeah. So that's been 10 years, so 98.
And one of the last things that I had found that listed in 1991, he was looking to get parole. This is kind of one of the last things, because I think by 1991, it wasn't a, there were other stories more important than this. And I hate to say that. It's not that I think that, but, you know, the reporters were just covering a murder that had happened you know, 15 years earlier. I feel like I have a little angel of Marianne telling me, tell my story.
Right.
Because other than the Detective magazine, which was published in 1980, and that was a very limited market for that, with today's podcasting and audio stories and things, there's a larger audience. But I don't want their memory to ever be forgotten, mm-hmm. you know, and that's very important to me. Thank you so much, Mary, for your time today. I really appreciate all of your insight and your witness testimony of what happened.
You are very welcome, and I wish you well on this whole thing. And if you need any more information, feel free to contact me.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Sonia, after listening to this interview, which I believe was fantastic, what were your feelings about what you saw when you first met her, personality-wise?
I initially spoke with Mary on the phone. She returned my call, and this was in early January, and told her what my project was. And she had given me a lot of information over the phone, but I really wanted to talk to her in person. So we set up an interview, and I went to her home. And she, when she answered the door, she looked great. She was a lot younger than I had thought, and she was very astute, very polite, and super helpful. Just really wanted to help with telling the story and was able to provide me a lot of information. And as you know, her memory was incredible, and I just felt very honored to have talked with her. And, you know, I told her that.
One of the things that I got from the interview is how well she recalled the specific day when she went over to Pearson's place. And to this day, 50 plus years later, she still has that vivid recollection of that, which is probably what made her such a good witness in the trial.
Yep, I think so. And that was really interesting. And she had questions for me, because one of those burning questions was, whatever happened to the boy? And that has been a burning question for many involved in the case, because little information had been known. And she asked me, if you ever find out about what happened to him, please let me know. What I found interesting is that she remembered the dogs. In fact, she was a large part of taking the dogs, and she kept one, and she had rehomed the other dog. And that, you know, we both had very similar stories about the family, the girls, Pauline, her likes, her dislikes, her golfing, the music, the dogs, and everything. So, you know, we were definitely remembering a lot of the same elements and a lot of the same behaviors. And like she had said, is she had came home and told her mom, yeah, that guy next door is very weird. He's just strange. And I would say she was older than me, so she talked with him on a whole different level than what I would have had talked to him at 8 years old. And just knowing that something wasn't right in that house when she went to go and help him clean out the house on Claremont.
And I believe she said she was 22 years old when this happened. And yeah, interesting about her husband working on Pearson's car, that I felt was interesting. If you think that what we covered today was good, we're going to have a lot more detail about his life in Biloxi. With information that Sonia was able to get, we're going to discuss that on episode 4 of Investigated.
Awesome. Looking forward to it. There's a lot to tell. Can't wait.
All right. See you next time. Bye, Sonia.
See you next time. Thanks so much for listening. Be sure to follow Investigated on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, visit investigatedpod.com to visit our website to learn more about your hosts, Sonia Paz and Mark Kopchick. Follow us on social media and connect with us. Investigated is written, edited, and hosted by me, Sonia Paz, with story advisement and input from Mark Kopchick, and many thanks to the research of criminologist Clark Williams, and also to Allison Betts Goldman for her contributions to this story.